But now it's my great pleasure to introduce our plenary speaker, Martin Crumpin, from the University of Wales Centre for Advanced Welsh and Celtic Studies. Very impressive man, you know, when you look at the sort of background that he has, interactive arts, degree in MA in Celto-Roman studies, wide-ranging interests, you know, both in medieval Welsh history but also in the present day, always with a very high-tech dimension, always with a very visual dimension, and I think has been fantastically productive in all kinds of areas that you can see here, and not just, you know, in printed format, but also there's a lot of online facilities that he has helped to create. I mentioned the Visual Culture of Wales project, the Imaging the Bible in Wales project, and what particularly caught our eye is the Stained Glass in Wales project, which forms the sort of main emphasis of the talk today. So we're all looking forward to that. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much for the invitation. This conference is new to me, and Parish Studies is new to me, and I'd just like to make a couple of comments about that before I sort of kick in, really. Parish Studies as a term was new to me until I came across the conference, I think, just before you met last year. And it struck me, I mean, I've been an artist, I've sort of ended up, I think, as an art historian, but, increasingly, as I'll say now, I've become more and more interested in ecclesiastical art. You know, and I've really found very few academics working in the field, so it's been tremendous, really, here to come and meet many of you, see some really interesting papers concerning rood screens, the glaziers, patronage, and so there's so many areas here which I think, you know, we're picking up on. And I think, I found that Parish Studies, as a new term, has been an interesting context to try and explore what I've been interested in. And I also like to say that I also think this presents a really extraordinary opportunity for us. I think that the range of papers here, the interests here, provide a very good opportunity to, in terms of our outreach, this is something that Jonathan mentioned yesterday that we didn't really get to talk about, but we'll talk about it later, which is that there's such a tremendous interest on the ground in a lot of the things we're doing, and yet there seems to be a huge disconnect with so many academic departments, and this is why I'm so pleased to have come here to Warwick to see what you're doing here in the field. And I think there's really a lot of opportunities in terms of harnessing expertise from all kinds of societies. We've got Trevor from the Ecclesiological Society, you know, people like the Church Monument Society. There's a huge amount of expertise in our field, certainly in terms of visual culture, which isn't really being harnessed and brought together. And I think, you know, it would be really, somebody, I've failed to persuade anybody in Wales, you know, somebody needs to kind of begin to harness and bring these things together. And perhaps that's something we can think about. Right. Okay. The title of my talk refers to visual culture in the modern age. And I'm going to think about the modern age in two ways. That's because mainly I should be talking about Victorian and 20th century artwork, and which is something we haven't heard much about, perhaps for good reasons, and also in a different sense, I'm thinking about it in a technologically modern age of electronic resources and publications. Now, having said that, I'm going to deal with the modern period. You can relax a little bit. I'm going to start back in the Middle Ages to establish a bit of context and a bit of ideas about where this research has come from and some of my perspectives on it. And I want to ask the question, where do we find the great works of medieval artwork in Britain? Where are they now? Now, often we think, well, we go to the National Gallery, go to the British Museum to find these things. But the point is, apart from manuscript illustrations in our great libraries, the greater amount of this material is to be found in our churches. We've got architecture and figure sculpture, stained glass, wall painting, this is a panel painting from Llandaff Cathedral in the 15th century. Now, some of this material has found its way into museum collections, but this is something that an audience here will appreciate better than most, but to find the best medieval art in England and Wales, you've really got to find yourself in provincial cathedrals, parish churches, all the way from Cumbria to Kent, or from Anglesey to Norfolk. In situ, I think that these treasures sort of democratise our medieval art right across the country. There are situations in other countries where, you know, these things have been taken out, looted, if you like, for, you know, now to be found, or liberated, if you like, in museums and galleries. But they're brought out from their original context, out of their devotional context in churches. This, of course, has made it very difficult for institutions who, for very good reasons, want to educate us on the nature and significance of medieval art in Britain, to mount exhibitions such as the V&A's Gothic Art for England exhibition of 2003. And there wasn't sufficient material in private and public collections to do it, so it necessitated the expensive and difficult removal of important works from churches down to London. I'm also glad to say that despite being called Art for England, it included a couple of very important manuscripts commissioned by Welsh patrons. Only periodically, then, does the wonderful variety of medieval ecclesiastical art get the chance to shine in a gallery setting, presented for the adoration of the art connoisseur rather than the devout, or indeed the church crawler. But when we move from the 16th century into the 17th and 18th centuries, this same ecclesiastical tradition of artwork, monumental sculpture in particular, is then eclipsed by the wealth of contemporary sculpture and painting that's been moved through purchase or gift to private houses and then into museum collections. And the visual culture placed in churches of successive generations has been increasingly neglected and marginalised to the point where it's barely acknowledged as being part of the European tradition of fine art. And it's very easy to be dismissed as being provincial. And this, for example, is in the same church as the great Jesse window I showed you just before, in Llanrhaid yr Ynghymell. And this sculpture is by a local sculptor, Robert Wynne, producing beautiful Baroque work. But this isn't sort of part of the story of Western art. Now, this has taken place in the context of the rising preeminence of painting. And it's no coincidence that painting is more easily commodified, transportable, and therefore much easier for museums and galleries to store and display, and for dealers to buy and sell. The trend continues today, so the copyright law, for example, offers much greater restriction on the reproduction of graphic works in a way that does not protect the work of a sculptor, weaver, or a stained glass artist, these works being classified as works of artistic craftsmanship. So by the time that the Renaissance gave way to the Baroque, the visual culture of churches found itself outside of the mainstream of high art and has only occasionally and fleetingly recovered this position. Even when this has been the case, it's often when artists are better known for their painting have produced works in other media. And there's a few examples that would be better, of course, than the work of Graham Sutherland and John Piper here in Coventry Cathedral. But artists working in as stone or wood carvers, as weavers or in stained glass, seem to have been set aside in the perceived distinction between art and craft. As fashions change, the reputation of sculptors in particular have faded. Now, at Llandaff Cathedral, visitors may well go to see this beautiful large triptych by Rossetti, and perhaps also the examples of stained glass by William Morris's firm in the 1860s and 70s. However, the contemporary sculptural work here of Henry Hugh Armstead is much less celebrated. This is despite the fact that the artist was responsible for important commissions such as the friezes on the Albert Memorial in Hyde Park, but he's unknown to us today. The Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood included a sculptor among its seven founding members, and for his work I had to climb several flights of stairs to a storeroom to see Thomas Woolner's Moses Standing Before the Glory of God, which was once a panel on the side of the pulpit. Again, this was made about the time of the restoration of the cathedral by the architects John Pritchard and J.P. Seddon in about 1860. So together with this altar frontal, which was made by Jane Morris and her sister Elizabeth, it's here in Llandaff Cathedral, rather than any museum in Wales, that we find the best collection of Pre-Raphaelite art in Wales. It's true that to a popular culture hooked on painting and the cult of the artist, the appeal of 19th century ecclesiastical sculpture and stained glass may seem more than a little tired and dull. And I hope that in this session I can throw a little more light on the vast and varied visual culture in places of worship from Wales from the 19th and 20th centuries, which I've encountered over the course of a series of research projects while based at the University of Wales Centre for Advanced Welsh and Celtic Studies in Aberystwyth. I don't think I'm alone in the field in having been initially drawn to medieval art when I began to churches, where before I think I might have ignored many stained glass windows in pursuit of medieval stone carving. I've now got to a point where sometimes I'm more interested in an 1880s window than I am by a 14th century corbel. My own journey really began when I was employed on the Vision Culture Wales project, which was run from the Centre in 1996 until 2003. The intention of the project was to publish a three-volume series of books outlining the history of visual culture in Wales from the early period up to about 1960. And I worked on the project and the accompanying set of CD-ROMs in particular. That was my main responsibility. Presented it in what we tried to do in a more imaginative way. We had a problem, a lovely problem, where we had a beautiful book, but the conditions of our grant, interestingly, required us to make electronic versions of it. So having started with a beautiful book, we then said, well, what do we do electronically to make something more? And we did this, you know, hopefully very successfully on the CD-ROMs, which won awards, I have to say. So the project was led by art historian Peter Lord, who developed an approach to art history in Wales which was more attuned to what there was in Wales rather than what was perceived as being missing. What previous writers had not found in Wales, that which fitted neatly into the established story of a European art tradition, led writers such as David Bell to conclude in his book The Artist in Wales that at no time, since the Norman Conquest at any rate, has the Welshman had any visual artistic tradition. Demonstrating a similar position, Wyn Griffiths, who was the chairman of the Welsh Committee of the Arts Council of Great Britain, stated in 1951, "So much for the past. No patron, no critic, therefore no painter, no sculptor, no Welsh art." And David Bell kindly excused the Welsh. "A small peasant people like the Welsh," he said, "does not, cannot provide the conditions in which the crafts can be found on any but an elementary level. Wales lack the patronage, in essence," he went on, "to provide for the great painters, the fine cities, handsome books, or beautiful stained glass." And this was the accepted position in Wales, concerning the period up to the 1950s at least, until the 1990s. There was no Welsh art. Now, avoiding the cliches or excuses of Wales being the land of song or of an almost puritanical religious nonconformism, the publications of the Visual Culture Wales series look not only to the Welsh material in the main public collections and to the few Welsh artists who have made their names in London, Paris or Rome, but to work in municipal and private collections to trace the visual arts of Wales. A continuum stretching from ephemera, popular prints, ceramics, sculpture, to photography and film, as well as painting and drawing by amateur, artisan and academically trained artists. We also found plenty of patrons. Going back to the medieval times, we found the patronage of people like William Herbert of Raglan and John Dunn of Kidwelly back in the 15th century. And then if you go forward to the 18th century, you've got Sir Watkin Williams Wynne, based up in North Wales, great patronage in London as well as up his home up at Wynnstay. But there was also this broader visual culture, which in many sense was beyond what we might normally call art, and a great amount of material that had rarely received any scholarly attention, and it readily spilled over the pages of the book onto the larger canvases of the accompanying CD-ROMs. This is a screen from Imaging the Nation, the middle one. I put the Welsh one up just to remind me to tell you that all of these publications were published in English and in Welsh. Richard and Magdalen Herbert, incidentally, were descendants of the Herbert family from Raglan. The challenge of photographing all this work needed for publication was immense, and much of the material was not in museums that could supply their own photographic transparencies. Remember, this is pre-digital, for publication. The problem was still greater for the medieval volume, because apart from the manuscript material, the majority of the imagery was to be found in parish churches and cathedrals. Now, in this instance, we commissioned photographers to gather the material needed, and the decision was made to photograph most of the sculpture in this sort of dramatic lighting, usually removing it from its architectural context and presenting it, I think, as museum pieces. Now, the intention was consciously to elevate the material, to achieve an attention that we felt it deserved. This was extended to the high production values of the book and the CD-ROM, which, as I said, was made possible through a lottery grant from the Arts Council of Wales. There's another screen there from the CD-ROM to give you a flavour. The Herefordshire sculpture we were talking about earlier. Subsequently, on my own travels, the work and the photography caused some surprises. Now, this head in the centre here was one that Peter always used to use in his lectures. And he used to say, "Where's it from? Where's it from? Where do you think it's from?" People say, "Oh, it's Aztec or African or something." He said, "Oh, no, it's Pembrokeshire. I think a couple of years ago I went to the same church, Castle Martin, Again, not in pursuit of this, but in pursuit of some 1850s glass by Hardman & Co. And so, of course, I wanted to find this head. But what I found was this. It was eventually I found this. I walked around the church two or three times before I eventually found it at the eastern end of the north aisle. This is it. And this is the same picture. Now, it's my contention that effective photography is a recreation, if you like, a rediscovery of that which is already all around us, and yet somehow we seem to have lost. Now, that's a big thing, and that's another paper, but keep that one in mind. Now then, back to the modern age. The Visual Culture Wales project was brought to an end in 2003, although a related research project received an AHRC grant for a three-year programme in 2005. The Imaging of the Bible in Wales project was led by Dr. Martin O'Kane at the University of Wales Lampeter, although it was really conceived together with myself partly and with my colleague Dr. John Morgan Guy, who worked with me on the medieval material in the Visual Culture Wales series. Our intention was to research and interpret art that related to the biblical narrative in Wales, focusing on the period 1825 to 1975. And the project continued in a similar vein, in as much as the extensive field work and new photography was undertaken to gather material for the project. And we retained a really quite broad interpretation of visual culture, which I think is fundamental. Again, we searched museum and library collections for examples of biblical art. But at the outset, we saw the potential of researching artworks in places of worship, which we felt had received hardly any scholarly attention. The 19th and 20th century artwork in churches and chapels was a primary focus of our fieldwork, and it really marked the beginning of my own serious interest in the subject as I worked as a photographer and researcher on the project. During this project, we built up a database of work that we were recording, and that was made available at the end of the project in 2008. And this was augmented in 2010 by a book of edited papers on the table here, edited by my colleagues Martin O'Kane and John Morgan Guy, called Biblical Art from Wales. And there was my own DVD-ROM, which is included in the book, and there's also the online database. Now, the DVD-ROM links directly onto the online database, so we kind of tried to create a sort of coherent package of print, electronic and online electronic, if you like. And again, we were very concerned with the production values, aware that in order to draw attention to this material, again, this is our primary purpose, we want people to see this, you know, we had to pay very close attention to the way in which the artwork was presented and interpreted. Now, you've been seeing a few of these. This is a sort of a taster, if you like. I'll take you into just one theme, which will give you a flavour of what we were trying to do. Of course, bear in mind that, you know, we weren't just looking in churches and chapels, although that was a big part of it. So there's a broad sweep of things here, but this will, I think, will illustrate what we try to do.
We always give thanks to God for all of you, constantly remembering before our God and Father your work of faith and labour of love.
Just bear in mind that we were coming to this from the perspective, yes, of visual art, but also from biblical studies. Martin O'Kane, who directed the project, was a biblical scholar, Hebrew scholar, but his interest was in the way in which the Bible had been recreated, retranslated, if you like, through other media in contemporary culture, and particularly in visual art. So, again, we embedded all of these themes within a biblical quotation, a biblical idea, which we tried to expand. And this section on art and faith, you know, draws on this idea about creating work as a labour of love. So if I go forward, for example, here, we look at here at the role of the ecclesiological movement and the Tractarian movement and Pugin, the point at which churches again became decorated, often following medieval styles. Here's a supreme, sublime example of this up at Pentrobyn, just outside Harden in North Wales. This extraordinary church was decorated by a single man who was a curate. This is what the ecclesiology.
Today, we are about to introduce our readers to a monument of clerical art so remarkable that we almost regret that its distance from London, lying as it does just within Wales, must always be an obstacle to the influence which its example might otherwise carry. The resident curate of this church, Mr. Troughton, has for many years made it his labour of love to decorate it with his own hands. Every window is filled with painted glass, designed and burnt by himself, comprising subjects on Brazil grounds of a very creditable execution, resembling Mr. Wales's better productions.
Here I can just show you a few additional images of it. There's a plaque at the back of the church laid by Gladstone in 1898, which records that Troughton did all this work. At no point to the detriment of his parish duties, he was eager to point out. But my goodness, I mean, what was he doing? I mean, he did this over a period of, you know, perhaps 10 years. He's copying Overbeck and the Nazarenes, Peter Cornelius, in some of these murals. This is examples of the glass that talks about. Some of the enamel was fading on the north wall a little bit. Good examples of it. So here we've got a roof screen with the apostles on. The altar. It's extraordinary. There's, I think this is a copy of Peter Cornelius. Does it say? No, it doesn't say. Okay, got little captions there. It's a direct copy of a painting which is lost, I think. He carved all these angels, did all the stenciling. Extraordinary work. Oh, there we are. There's the... Right. So, what else have we got? We've also got the example of people like glassmakers Morris, Burne-Jones, C. Kent in particular, people who initially went to Oxford to train for the clergy, of course. The idea soon wore off for Morris. But again, seeing their work as very much a labour of love, and in terms of a religious devotional work, really. And Kemp, I think, still sort of had that in mind. This is some examples, more clerical art. Joshua Stansfield, is it? Down in Whitebrook, Reredos, painted there by the curate in the 1890s. This is a church which is now closed. I can't tell you what's happened to this. It probably has been destroyed. And here we've got J.D. Davis down in the Gower. Primarily as a wood carver, but we think he probably painted this as well. Here, going into the 20th century, Church at Llanwenog, where the local family carved a number of pieces, as well as Joseph Rubens, who worked on these as well. He was an emigre Belgian artist. Further emigre artists here at Lampeter. This is a Catholic church in Lampeter, and there were a number of artists, some of whom were from the Guild of Catholic Artists. This is notable because we were told that the figure of Pontius Pilate is actually a portrait here. Right, so then we've got various sort of other sections here which go to other sections as well. I've tried to sort of incorporate a number of pathways through the material so that, you know, it's not not always so linear. So again, looking at the section on patronage and the impetus for memorialisation through the commissioning of works of art, or indeed for the building of whole churches themselves as memorials, such as here at Brithdeer, where the church was in memory of Charles Tooth, who's depicted on the altar frontal here, in a beautiful work by Henry Wilson. Very difficult to photograph. Hard to see, isn't it? And then we've got Llanfair Cilgefn in Monmouthshire. Again, a whole set of Sgraffito panels by Hayward Sumner, which are really quite remarkable, totally unique in Wales. Now then... there's a question of context here. I talked a bit earlier about the images in the book, which were sort of divorced from their context. Now, with the aid of the database, we can unpack that. So if I... Oh, what's happened there? Okay, it's gone into... Sorry, I think it's the computer's directing a little bit slowly. It's taken me to another section, which I was going to show you, but to do with imagery or portraiture in these works. There. So this is the online database, and what you can now see is you can see the panel there, but what we've also got is a number of we've got a number of scenes here, so we can look at it in its own context. We can see other details of it, And we can then go to the church and see, well, where is this church? So we've got a Google map, picture of it, various links. So, for example, this is in a ownership of the Friends of Friendly Churches, so we can visit their site. And we've got things like the Royal Commission's Covline site as well, which gives us more information about some of these things. And we've got other items there as well. So, for example, here we've got a really quite extraordinary pulpit, again, made of copper. So what else have we got down here? These things are all subject index. There's bibliographical references here. My colleague John wrote a whole essay on this particular pulpit and the image, just the grapes imagery on it. I haven't got time to go there now. There's this sort of all this other context, if you like, that you can look at. So, for example, we looked at... there are no other works by Henry Wilson. We looked at the church. If we're interested in subject matter, again, subject matter was a big driver of this. And, if you want to look at other things, then we've got a selection of other things on the database linked with that theme, in this case, the vine or the Eucharist. Something rather more humble. This is a window, east window of St. John, Gandyfaith. Again, another church is now closed. I doubt this window will survive. There's other things there. Okay, so... the database really afforded us the luxury, if you like, of being able to publish hundreds of additional images that didn't neatly fit into the narrative of the DVD-ROM or the themes in the book. And, of course, this was something that was just totally unimaginable 15 years ago when we worked on the Visual Culture Wales books. And, of course, again, the convenience, the ease of digital photography helped us considerably. And we were able to publish over 3,000 images on this database at the end of a three-year project, which was about, we gathered about that number of images for the whole of an eight-year project on the Visual Culture of Wales. And I was struck by how little crossover there was between the two projects. Now, if you've got a history of art in Wales, three-volume history of art in Wales, you think you've got quite a lot of stuff, yeah? Well, I would say in the 3,000 images that I put online here, there was only about a dozen images that crossed over. So why is that? Well, in medieval vision, in medieval volume... we naturally looked to churches to find medieval art. It didn't occur to us to look for art in churches in the 19th century, the 20th century. And therefore, we sort of opened up this whole new world, if you like, of visual art within a sort of small part of a nation's art tradition. In fact, there was just a single screen on the middle CD-ROM, Imaging the Nation, which had... images of the Epstein Majestas and the Piper windows in Llandaff Cathedral. That was all there was. So out of that, we've managed to gather a great amount. And other sort of problems were resolved as well. For example, when we dealt with gentry patronage, particularly painting, on the CD-ROM again, I remember Peter coming in to me and said, I can't find gentry patronage in the 19th century. It's gone. I've got no examples of it, nothing there. And of course, what were the gentry spending their money on in the 19th century? Well, they were building churches. They were putting in stained glass windows in memory of their family members. And this is, this is a whole area that we sort of managed to pick up. For example, I mentioned... the restoration at Llandaff Cathedral by Seddon and Pritchard. Well, Pritchard was a diocesan architect down in Glamorgan. His church here at St. Catherine Baglan is, really one of his masterpieces, really. This was, interestingly, at the expense of his cousin. The church was commissioned, no expense spared. We've got work here again by Armstead. We saw his sculpture in Llandaff Cathedral, his painting here by Armstead. And we've got... windows by Morris & Co. as well. So here, if painting is your thing, of course, we can do that. For example, if we put in, we have a way of searching different types of works here. So if I put in painting and location as well. Let's get a few things here. I'll show you this one. This is a Reredos in St Mary Monmouth. And our experience of it was really quite interesting. There'd been something going on in the church. I wasn't quite sure what it was, but there was little ladies about, there was flowers and things. But anyway, we went there, we came to photograph this thing. And at the end of the chancel, you've got this big black rectangle. And in fact, the rector was saying, oh, you know, it's so dark. And we come to look at this because we'd seen a reference to it. It might kind of, you know, hide it away somewhere. So I went out to the car and brought the studio lights in and put them at either side and put the switch either side. And there was almost a gasp in the church. And they went, gosh. And some people went off to find their digital cameras to get photographs of it. These are parishioners that had never seen it. It was just black. It really struck me, again, these things are in our midst and yet we do not see them. So that's a particular example of that. Right, I'm going to try and go back to the slideshow now. Okay. So it's when visiting these places of worship for the Imaging Bible in Wales project that I began to record stained glass. And it's something that we identified, sometimes we identified churches that had significant or unusual examples of stained glass during the Imaging of the Bible in Wales project, such as Burne Jones' window up at Harden in Flintshire, his last work. This is Theodora Saul, who is an Adoration of the Magi, beautiful arts and crafts work of the 1930s in Monmouthshire, and things like modern works like Hugh Easton's Christ in Majesty and Roth. If you want a picture of that, I suggest you go to Holy Trinity in Coventry for a better version, I have to say. But it was also when visiting churches, when we weren't specifically looking for glass, that I found it all the time. So, for example, we went to look at this Martin Travers reredos, which you can't see very well here. But, of course, above it, you've got a big east window by A.L. Moore, and there's about four other windows in the church there. Other examples of that, for example, I went to see St. John the Baptist in Newport, where there's a lot of painted work, a beautiful set of painted Stations of the Cross by A.L. Henderson, who's a pupil of Comper. And, again, you've got work by Kemp & Co. There's a Comper window there as well. So, you know, I was sort of coming across these things all the time. And similarly, when we visited churches to photograph important biblical stained glass, such as this, again, a last great work by Wilhelmina Geddes in Lampeter, I was encountered a church which was full of glass, dating from 1875 onwards, and including, you know, good and bad. This is Robert Newbery of 1901, Commission to Peter. I should come back to Robert Newbery later. So therefore, I found that I was sort of inadvertently recording stained glass faster than any other medium, and I soon began to record not just biblical work, but also non-biblical saints and subjects. And I think it was also while working as a designer on the project that I became very conscious of the visual power of stained glass. I think I gradually, you know, I found myself overusing it. I might say, oh, there's too much stained glass on that leaflet. You know, I found, you know, on the website, I had to take it off. So I was sort of embarrassed by riches, if you like. And having tuned into stained glass while working on the project, I saw the potential of developing a new project purely interested in stained glass, drawing on both my archive of images and the technical infrastructure that we developed in the database. I'd already started to go out of my way to find stained glass, habitually calling in at churches, even when our initial research, which was principally the Pevensey's, of course, Britain's of Wales series, you know, to sort of see, you know, is there anything there worth having? This is an example of that, where I called in at the Catholic Church in Colwyn Bay and found a beautiful set of windows by Harry Clark Studios in the 1920s, totally unmentioned by Pevsner, you know, subsequently they were picked up and they were included in the book in Nicola Gordon Bowes' chapter on Harry Clark Studios and Wilhelmina Geddes. There's other work by Clark Studios here at Pantassaf, where... these are non-biblical figures, so again, you know, I began to pick these things up as I went along. So, with our technical consultant, Nigel Callaghan, who we approached to develop the Imaging of the Bible in Wales database, the underlying structure of the database was sort of changed to facilitate the coexistence of multiple data sets within a single database, so then they could be published to create discrete websites. Let's see what we've got. So if we go back to Baglan, for example, we can then click to go to the stained glass catalogue. Bearing in mind we've got sculpture and painting on there, whereas on this, we have another couple of non-biblical windows, but no sculpture and painting. So So anyway, so we've got this catalogue which shares all of the biblical windows, obviously, recorded for the Imaging the Bible in Wales project, but there's also common information about designers, site details, bibliographies and things. And I managed to get funding to work part-time over a series of contracts between October 2009 and 2011 to augment the material. And during this period, a number of windows in the database rose threefold to give what is now, I think, the largest online photographic collection of 19th and 20th century stained glass that I've come across. There are currently well over 2,000 images listed, windows listed, and there's about 6,000 images or so. I also paid particular attention to filling in some of the gaps that I perceived in the catalogue, and this included material outside of the project dates, which was set of 1825 to 1975. So I then went and photographed and added examples of medieval and imported continental glass, and of also some more new work made in the last 30 years. And this was particularly important because in Swansea, we've got the Swansea Institute, where there's a course teaching stained glass, which is internationally important, and there's a number of architectural glass artists who are sometimes still based in Wales or moved away, and they've got work in the locality. So people like Graham Jones and Kuni Kajiwara, as well as Alexander Belashenko and Amber Hiscott, who trained and are still based near Swansea. Let's have a look at... So here we've got the Pulpitum screen, 2006, by Alex Belashenko at the medieval priory of Iweni. So, as I showed you, in recognising the different stances of the two resources, we enable them to be accessed from each other, and so that you know you could go between the two different sorts of data. And I was also very aware of the context of other databases, online databases, and I wanted to make as part of that. For example, I talked about Kovline briefly. This is the Royal Commission's Kovline site. Which is a much more of an architectural resource, really, giving site descriptions and details of more online images in this case. And then also this being a monastic site, linked to Monastic Wales, again, another project that I worked on a little while ago. Monastic Wales, looking at obviously monastic sites in Wales. So again, you're trying to sort of locate a broader context for those. That's opened in the same window. As well. So then in North Wales, let's have a look at Derwen. We've got a couple of windows there. We've got a very good resource in terms of the Clwyd Powys Historic Churches Survey. So again, a lot of North Wales churches have got links to that resource. Again, you've got very detailed architectural information provided here, and I've tried in most cases just to put a sentence or sometimes a paragraph on the site itself, but again I haven't sort of felt the need to kind of present an architectural history here, because in a way it's not my job, and other sites do that a lot better. And then there's other relevant sources. For example, this is a Friends of Friends Churches site, so this should link to their own website, which again gives further images of the church itself, and then again, I've linked to the architects as well. Sometimes there's very brief notes on the architects as well. So it'll take a bit of a while to load. There we are. So there's the Friends of Friends Churches. So you've got a set of pictures in my picture as well, actually. But so we can see the screen and everything else. Now, we've got another set of links at the top, some general links, which I think are worth mentioning. For example, I've got some sites here under visiting where we've got details of church trails and visiting some of these sites. I've also got a site on studios where I've listed people making stained glass now. I often get asked, as I go around, oh, do you know somebody could fix that window? So this is a little list of artists working in Wales with websites. And then again, I've got links to other resources in terms of stained glass. So there's a variety of things there. In particular, if interesting, talking about modern glass, Buckstone Glass is a very good site, something that I've used quite a lot in trying to attribute some of these windows. Now, it's the simple information about date and artist that's often very, very difficult to find. The subjects, I think, are not too much of a problem once your eye is tuned in, and I was, gradually kind of began to identify subjects quite easily. But because you can see them. Now, sometimes you've got commemorations, and that can give you clues to dates. There might be memorial plaques around as well. But the absence of a basic framework for attributing and dating these windows is often quite a hindrance to the understanding and appreciation of stained glass around us. The dates and makers are also among the basic starting points people want to search the material as well as locations and subjects. And during the course of my research in stained glass, I've become increasingly able to date and to attribute many windows that have not yet been published at all and certainly not been attributed or dated. Now, in the first half of the 19th century, glass painters would sometimes sign their windows, and this sort of died out, really, until the end of the century and then into the early 20th century, when sometimes artists or studios would add a mark or a monogram, perhaps, to their windows. And, of course, the NADFAS Guide to Stained Glass Marks and Monograms is the best source in this respect, and I've used that. But I've also gradually sort of consciously recorded marks as I've gone along, again, as I've become more interested in glass. Let's actually use the search thing here. So this is pretty much the same as we had an image in the Bible. So if I put in bell, I get a whole host of things. Joseph Bell and Son, for example. We've got a set of windows, three pages, in fact, of windows by them. But then also I can show signatures and maker's marks. And if I can find this one here from Crenant, is unusual in that that's the main window. It details the people who actually work trying to. This is great for a historian, but apparently at the time when it was dedicated, the bishop complained that it was like a little advert. You can't have little adverts in the church. Anyway, so they didn't do that very often. Dates are sometimes found in dedication, but frequently these only record a death date, and so they can only be useful in dedicating the earliest possible date for a making of a window. And even here there are exceptions. There's windows that were, in memory of people who died quite a long while ago, sometimes even 100 years ago, which somebody said, oh, yes, I'll have a window, and, oh, well, Auntie Mabel, it's Auntie Mabel, and, she died years ago. You can be caught out with that sometimes as well. And it's also the case that a window could be... added many years after somebody had died. But the vast majority of stained glass windows were unsigned, and therefore they're not clearly dated. So we need to look for published and archived sources to provide the dates and names of makers. And chief among the published sources, of course, are the Buildings of Wales series, the Pevsners, and the quality of these are very variable in Wales, but they're also not infallible. Now, sometimes church guides and leaflets provide details about artwork in churches. They might cite information found in church archives or faculties. And I've sometimes established dates and makers from the steadily growing volumes of studies, large and small, on individual studios and artists. And I've also been able to attribute and sometimes date many windows stylistically. Over time, I've been able to recognise styles and sometimes spot the reuse of cartoons and designs by particular firms that have been signed or attributed elsewhere. Let's go and give you an example of this. If I put in... So here, I was fortunate to be put in touch with the church archivist, who was able to tell me that this window was by Bolas and Grills, which she identified from the records, made in the 1920s, beautifully painted. Sentimental, I agree. But anyway, so we've got an attribution of Bolas and Grills. Now, if I open, show you two things together. I'm working on an unfamiliar computer. Here we are. Open the computer. Let's So that window being vaguely in the back of my mind, I then saw it again at Llangattock down in Southern Powys. You get that feeling, oh, I've seen that before. So just to compare the two, there's the one, I'm just going to the bottom. Notice you don't have the, you've got these diamond quarries at the top, whereas here we've got nice backgrounds. Now the interesting thing is, this is 1880s, the other one was 1920s, astonishing conservatism of style. But the other point is that, again, I don't think that, I think the perhaps are probably attributed to Clayton Bell, but I didn't mention anything about this one. And by the style of the sort of the Germanic landscape in the background, I was then able to attribute more windows that were in the chancel. They're clearly by the same designer, same artist, same hand. So, you know, they're going to be Burleson and Grills as well. I mean, not 100%, but, you know, 98% sure that they're... So suddenly, out of this one connection, which came through a church archivist, I've now attributed another set of, you know, three or four windows. And this is how the corpus sort of grows up over time. So I mentioned Robert Newbery earlier in Lampeter. Newbery were unusual in that they seem to make a lot of windows in Wales. They're a London firm. Most of these firms were English, of course. There were no Welsh firms until Curtic Studios were established in the 1940s. But this window at Llantrysant, sorry, same thing again. You know, I've seen this before, you know, and I managed to find that the St. George over on the left is repeated. I found him again at St. Isles down in Pembrokeshire, among a number of attributed Newbery windows. And then, having attributed this window, I was able to attribute another window at Glasbury, where I've got this panel, which is a single light window, which is a Boer War memorial in Glasbury. So again, I've got another window. And then the figure of St. David, well, I found that again, I recorded previously, at Llanfair Rhydderthorn in Mid Wales. And then again, I've got the same figure on the east window at Bishopston, down in the Gower. And then I've got this same figure, not as a knight, but the same figure at the foot of a crucifixion. So they've reused this figure, you know, probably, you know, they've lifted it, put it on a different design. So, and then again, the left-hand light at Bishopston has got a figure which is St. Taylor, and that St. Taylor is the same cartoon is reproduced again at St. Isles, down in Pembrokeshire, but instead of St. Taylor, he's now St. Elvan. These are, you know, they're figures. What do they look like? Well, it's another question. Now, all of this sort of seems, you know, quite obvious here, but making these connections, you know, are quite tricky. And I've got numerous windows in the back of my mind thinking, oh, I've seen that before somewhere, you know. So gradually you sort of, you know, move on. So, what next? I see time's catching up with us. What next? The stained glass project has officially come to an end, and I hope that there's a good representative sample of stained glass in parish churches in Wales. There's many further dates and attributions that need to be established, as well as much more material that needs to be gathered. There's a lot of ongoing archive work there, which ideally should be done. But we didn't get the funding for this. And for this reason, I wanted to create a mechanism whereby people could contribute to the work that we've got here. So, for example, there's a system whereby if you look at a window and for whatever reason you want to help me attribute it or date it or any information at all, you can just submit a comment which then comes through to me that I can then respond to. I'll just give you an example of that. I had a lovely example of somebody came to me and said, oh, yes, I know who those people are. And so he wrote to me and, you know, explained who the figures were. You do get a tradition in some instances where you get portraits, particularly this firm, Ward and Hughes in London. And again, there's another thing that we've done whereby people can add a new window to the collection, so they can sort of submit a window, if you like, with or without an image. And there's been an expert up in North Wales who's been particularly working on Trina Cox, and he's sent me a number of windows by her. So, for example, here, this is his description. So, again, I attribute the people who sent me windows and then any additions that I make. This one, just to show you, is from the school. Now, obviously, I've been talking about artwork in churches, not artwork in chapels, and not stained glass in other places as well. So, obviously, stained glass is a broader field than just parish studies, but that's the parish studies is the strength of this resource, I should say. So I spoke about the way in the core database was developed to include multiple collections, and I'd just like to say briefly that there are two further collections which we will be introducing into the resource at some stage, hopefully during the next year, one of which is the photographic archive from the Visual Culture Wales project, which would have a lot of medieval material as well, might be of interest to people, and that will be at least listed and in some cases illustrated on a new database which assists alongside it as well. And I will also bring you exclusive news of a new collection which we're going to bring along, which will be about Welsh tombs, medieval Welsh tombs, which we're also hoping to launch during the next year. So, we're hoping that the database as a core idea, is going to carry on growing. And in theory, as an image collection, it can hold any sort of image really anywhere really. And so we've got the sort of the framework of the place names and the churches and the artists and things. So we can use that as a sort of framework on which we can hang, many more things. In conclusion, the visual culture found in our parish churches dating from after the time of Reformation has been routinely ignored by art historians, not to mention religious historians and many architectural historians. I appreciate that Victorian stained glass might not be to everybody's taste. It's dismissed as mass-produced and conventional, sentimental. But for those who worshipped in its midst, this is an important visual culture that has an effect on people, effect on their spirituality, on their belief, good and bad. And by opening our eyes to this visual culture, we begin to find that there's whole galleries of visual art that lie unappreciated and unnoticed in many communities across the whole of the country. But it's a visual culture about which we know very little. If you ask many people if they've got any stained glass, they say, oh yes. What's it like? Oh, it's wonderful. What's in it? Oh, I don't know. We saw a fantastic east window in church in Grangetown in Cardiff, where it was a fairly standard crucifixion scene, figures of saints, four light window in each of the four lights below. There were four scenes from the First World War. It's a First World War memorial. So you had, one with the Navy, and there was a little scene of the trenches. The vicar had been there for 30 years, and he'd never seen it. He didn't see it. And this is what we have is stained glass. Now, I realise to say people don't know about their glass. It's a very big generalisation. It's a real joy to come across well-researched, good little leaflets in churches which talk about their stained glass or carving and other artwork. Even if it's just a little A4 sheet, it's really very exciting. There is an increasing problem, which is that churches are increasingly at risk of closure. I deliberately showed you a couple of images which were in churches which were being closed. And this is a visual culture which is being lost. It's sometimes sold abroad, destroyed, once a church has been declared redundant. There's a bit of a market in the Far East for Victorian stained glass. You'd be interested to know. And of course, some cases, churches move their glass from one church to another, but it's going to be really quite expensive, and it's, particularly if you've got a church window which is high up and you've got scaffoldings involved, it can be almost as expensive as commissioning a new piece. So, Victorian wall painting, I think, is also something which you also need to concentrate on. I think that I have a feeling that Victorian wall painting is almost as rare as medieval wall painting in Wales. It's still being whitewashed today. I've come across examples where it would, oh yes, we painted that over last year, So there are all sorts of examples where artwork is at risk. And if we're to recognise the importance of this visual culture, wall painting, stained glass, sculpture, we need to understand much more about the artists who made it, its meaning, its purpose in the church. And it's my hope that the work we've done in Wales will help in this process, both within Wales and also beyond.
often a dazzling sort of display of both, I mean, effort and wizardry and sort of juxtaposition and integration and growth. So a very, very impressive you know, combination of research projects, which I think, you know, you rarely see something building up as integrally and as sort of in a very organized fashion as this. I mean, sort of perhaps my first question is, how do you organize your own work? I mean, how do you stay on top of all this material? I mean, it's all very organized here, but I mean, have you had disasters? Have you had things that you can no longer attribute? Have you lost key information, or were you... I mean, it just seems to me that the volume of this is becoming so enormous that I think, you know, how does one do that?
It's a very difficult question to answer. I mean, one thing at a time. You know, it has been a series of research projects. You know, one thing comes to an end, and that leads to other things. I mean, the problem is always, you know, has always been funding. I mean, I saw the potential to do stained glass quite late on in the Imaging the Bible in Wales project. But, you know, it was just impossible. You know, we weren't supported. You know, I said, well, there's a fantastic AHRC bid here. We tick all the boxes in terms of public engagement and impact and all these things, but they wouldn't let me pursue that, you know, and I ended up scratching around with private sources and little bits here and there. And so, I mean, I'm aware of a tremendous amount of loose ends. The other thing that I'm very aware of, and this, I've been very aware of this weekend, actually, which is that I've done a lot of visiting. I've visited a lot of churches. I've photographed hundreds and hundreds of windows. I've got thousands and thousands of photographs. But I'm very conscious that I haven't spent any real time, you know, doing any archival work on this, and that's a real gap in the research. And in that respect, you know, I feel a bit, you know, concerned about that. But on the other hand, I was heartened when we launched this resource. We had Anna Evis, who's the chair of the CVMA, the Medieval Stained Glass People, and she said, well, you know, the most important thing is just to get this stuff recorded. You know, we can deal with it later. So in a way, I feel that that's, you know, perhaps one approach. And again, you know, by making it open to people to say, well, you know, this is clearly Burleston Grove. Sometimes I say, oh, perhaps this is Clayton Bell, perhaps this is that. And so I'm hoping somebody will say, yes, it is. It doesn't happen very often, but if you want to, please do. You know, so perhaps, you know, again, there was the example of the archivist up in Pratsati, who I was in touch with, you know, and she sent me some really, you know, valuable information from their archives about the windows. I was able to date more of them, attribute a couple of them, although there were some maker's marks on a lot of them. So, that was an assistance. So, you know, that kind of engagement would be something that would be really, really useful. But in terms of publication, I mean, as I say, there's a lot of stuff online, but in terms of really exploiting it, I think we've barely scratched the surface. I mean, we've got this Book of Biblical Art from Wales, you know, which has got a lot of stuff, not just from churches, but, you know, and so I am trying somehow to write another couple of books, in fact, you know, to get this out. But, yes, it's a long process.
Yeah. That was absolutely fascinating. You're dipping your toe into crowdsourcing. And I wondered, two questions really. First, is there a quality control issue both over information and quality of photos? And secondly, does the future lie with crowdsourcing?
I think it does. What I didn't mention, which links back to what I said right at the very beginning, is Flickr. In terms of stained glass, Flickr is perhaps the best place to look for stained glass. I said mine was, but Flickr may have more. I don't know. You can't search it properly, but the stuff is there. If you want to look up Burleston and Grills, you put it in on Flickr and you get a lot of stuff. And so that's becoming a really good source. Now, at one stage, I had a chat with the CVMA about saying, you know, is there a way we can bring, kind of harness Flickr into a way of keeping this stuff together and then putting it out in perhaps a more scholarly way. Now, in terms of quality control, we've got a system whereby if somebody sends a comment, it doesn't get published. It comes to me and I say, fine, or I say no, or I say yes, but. Nothing is automatically added to the website. In terms of images, on the online form, it says any image is better than no image, because it's true. Because, you know, sometimes you'll have a thing in the pencil will say, you know, window by so and so. You don't know if it's big or small or what it is, you know. So, and even just a rough, bad picture of it, at least you can say, well, it's, you know, it's going to be the second half of the 19th century. You know, you can make some judgments about it. And of course, ideally, yes, well, as time goes on, perhaps, you know, we'll have better pictures come in. So in terms of image quality, I don't really mind. I mean, you know, Peter's pictures that he sent to me, you know, you know, all right. They're fine, and they do the job. There we are. Yeah.
Can you, without going into a sort of whole technical thing, a few quick tips about how do you actually do take a decent picture of a passable picture of a stained glass window? Because I mean, sure, we all crawl around and.
It's tricky. It's been
mine are always horrible.
The problem with stained glass is contrast. Mm. Now, often people say, "Oh, sorry, it's a dull day. You know, it looks lovely in the sunlight." And I go, "Great. If I'm photographing a window on the south wall on a sunny day, it's bad news. You need a dull day." And my secret is I photograph in raw and do the processing afterwards. I used to stop the camera down because I used to worry that I was burning the highlights out. But I now stop everything up because I can recover the highlights, but I can't recover the lowlights. So all the stuff I photographed in the first 3 years of the project is not as good as what I did afterwards. And it's all to do with software. Software has improved, so you can get more out of your photographs in a way that we couldn't do, you know, if only a few years ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you just explain, you said you raised your concerns about the loss of this. Are you saying that your findings, the significance of what you're finding, is not making its way into the decisions made about redundancy and what happens with the material culture and visual culture of these churches? And if it isn't, how can it?
I think on a general level, there's assumption among a lot of people that this stuff just isn't important. And I suppose that I'd like to think that the work on glass has said, well, you know, it is there, it is of interest. You know, there's a sort of a slight misconception that Victorian glass was mass-produced. I mean, I showed that example of the two windows which were basically the same. I can show you a lot more which were, you know, exactly the same. But even if these windows were copying other designs, they were all hand-painted, hand-fabricated. So, you know, I think they do have a value, and I think trying to educate people about that value. But the value is not monetary value. There was another instance where I was in a church I'd known for many years, actually, a church down in Newport, and I didn't worship there, but I knew people there. And even then, it was up for closure. You know, it was carpet warehouse territory, what we used to say in Newport. And it's still going, but I went there again a year or two ago, and the same problem there. They need £100,000 just to restore the, you know, to repair the floor, let alone what's on top. And so I said, "Oh, you've got a beautiful set of glass here. I mean, how much is it worth? Can we flog it?" You know, and of course, it's not going to make a huge amount of money. And the more churches are being made redundant, this is an accelerating process. Even if you do try and sell them, it basically will deflate the market. You know, so the value really is its local value in terms of being memorials and, you know, part of, you know, a church's life. So there's some big problems coming up. For example, there was a big church in Llanelli that I recorded for the Friends of Friendless Churches, actually. You've got some really, you know, impressive big windows in there in a big town church, which is now going to be closed. I can't imagine what will happen to that. You know, I mean, the question of what you do with these buildings is fraught enough. But in terms of, you know, the beautiful sculpture at the East End, as well as all the stained glass, big five-light window by Caitlin Bale, good example of their work, big windows by Newbury, big windows at the far end by somebody I can't remember. You know, so I just don't know what will happen to that, you know, and there's going to be more examples like this.
You know, what's the equivalent of a DAC with advisors who advise on removing these things? And
I don't know enough about this. There's very strict rules, of course, about what you can and can't do, you know, in terms of faculties, until a church is made redundant, and then all hell breaks loose, I think. And so, you know, it's a question of acting at the right time.
How do you get involved at all?
I'm not sure. I don't know enough about this, to be honest.
You started off by saying the glass isn't in the museum, and it seems to me you've made a very powerful case for a stained glass museum in Wales where these panels are going.
There's another thing which I'd like to add to that, which is that down at Swansea, the Swansea course now, it's now Swansea Metropolitan University, they've got a fantastic archive of maquettes and cartoons and drawings by all the students there over the last 50, 60 years. Now they have, at last, they've got an MPhil student who's going through that archive. That in itself would make a wonderful, a beautiful museum. And then, as you say, yes, to bring these things in, you know, it's going to have to be the more portable ones. I mean, there's only one stained glass museum in the whole of the country, you know, that's the Ely. But yes, there's a very good case for that. And the thing about Swansea, of course, is that they are currently in the same building as the old library. And years ago, you know, we would say, well, you know, there's a really good opportunity for that. So, yes, absolutely. And it'd be good if a project like this could be the foundation of some sort of stained glass museum in Wales. But I'm sure the problems are closer to home here as well. Yeah. But they're big things. It costs a lot of money to get these things out.
There is a fellow around called Philip Bannum, who's a magic lanternist. And I went to a series of lectures he gave. The first thing he did was to give everybody a piece of glass and some paints that were made by Cannings of Birmingham for painting on glass. It must be a very specialised subject for artists. Is there somewhere where they're trained? Because the glass doesn't absorb the paint.
Yes, well, I mean, I think there was a course up in Sunderland and a course in Swansea. The Royal College of Art closed some years ago. So, that yes, it's a very specialised training process. But it does go on, and there are people doing it. You know, there are people who are, you know, very, very skilled in glass painting and restoration. So yes, it's a very, very skilled technique. I've had a couple of offers of people saying, "Come and make glass for me," which is lovely, but I haven't got around to that yet. One of these days, I will.
You say you've become almost more interested now in some of these modern features in churches. So how would you sell to sort of a diehard medievalist? How would you sell the sort of 19th and 20th century art? What do you think are their most sort of appealing features to you, who also knows a lot about the Middle Ages? So what do you think, is it elements of style or in terms of the size of them, or how would you try and explain your own sort of conversion to a certain extent?
My interest is slightly unusual in that, you know, not being a medievalist, I'm very interested in the way that the medieval has been revived and reinvented. So the Gothic revival material has been of great interest to me. But if you want to convert somebody to stained glass, you've got to show them arts and crafts glass of the 1910s, 1920s. If you look at the very first slide I showed you, the Carl Parsons Good Samaritan, you know, that kind of work, it really makes you think. And this whole issue about, oh, well, it's, you know, art and craft, you know, I mean, forget it. I mean, the craftsmanship, the artistic craftsmanship involved in making windows like that, like the Harry Clark Studios windows, you know, are just extraordinary. And, you know, if somebody says to me, oh, well, it's not very good, you know, I give up. and in terms of modern work, I mean, you know, I didn't do a lecture which kind of did a sweep of stained glass in Wales. That would have been a different sort of lecture. But, you know, again, in terms of some of the modern work by Amber Hiscott, who I mentioned, Roger Heyman, and, you know, some really, really beautiful work of Lawrence Lee, who taught the Royal College of Art. He's got windows here in Coventry Cathedral, but he's got a couple of examples of his work in Wales. They're really beautiful pieces, you know. And, you know, it's not just a case of painting on glass. I mean, this glass is treated as acid etched, you know, it's painted on the inside, on the outside. There's a tremendous complexity to the way that you can deal with glass, you know, and the whole way that, you know, this is why antique glass is so important, because it's got these little bubbles in it, you know, it's not a perfect sheet, so you've got these all kinds of interesting effects of light on it. So it's a real a science as much as an art as well, yeah.
Okay, I think we can just say many thanks for taking us on this.